The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
Very good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. You're watching Squawk Box. The S&P closing at a record high. That's the seventh positive day in a row, boosted by Tesla. But IBM shares weigh on the Dow, which moves lower on the day. Evergrande averting a potential default as the Chinese property developer reportedly sends funds for a key interest payment, which is due on Saturday. That sent the shares in the group a little higher.
A strong demand for luxury products helps L'Oreal's third quarter sales forecast. The French group's CEO says that the key market's appetite for beauty is not satisfied. Snap shares sink by over 20% in extended trade, pulling other social media groups lower, as the company warns Apple's recent privacy changes are disrupting its advertising business.
And EU leaders criticise Poland in a row over the role of European law as they gather in Brussels. But Poland's Prime Minister says he will not bow to pressure.
We will not act under the pressure of blackmail. We're ready for dialogue. We do not agree to constantly expanding the scope of competences, but we will, of course, talk about how to resolve the current disputes in agreement and in dialogue.
And we'll be giving you coverage of that leaders' meeting, obviously, throughout the programme this morning and talking a little bit more about this difference of opinion with Poland. But let's just catch you up on what happened in the markets overnight. One of the early notes I've seen this morning talking about the China syndrome affecting European markets. Concerns, obviously, about Evergrande and whether it would make this offshore bond payment due Saturday. Perhaps upsetting the apple cart when it comes to the European trading session. But when you look at the US, difficult to see that really having much of a drag on the way the broader S&P 500 performed here. There were some individual issues as far as the Dow Jones Industrial Average is concerned, and we'll talk about that IBM story. And of course, there are some individual issues here to do with the NASDAQ as well, and we'll talk about this story. The NASDAQ, though, managed to close the session up 0.6%. But later in the day, I think we started to see some reaction in the technology stocks from the big decline we saw in Snap. And very interesting, this all comes back to the way Apple is adjusting its privacy settings and what ultimately that means for companies that hope they will benefit from Apple's own marketplace. So let's move on and let's just show you what happened in the Treasuries, because we are monitoring the curve very closely, as you know here, just to see, one, what the shape of the curve is, two, to what extent the two-year note is repricing expectations around interest rate hikes and tapering. And as we look at the 10-year and just focus on this pivotal yield here, which is so important for pricing mortgages and so on and so forth. We're 1.68 here, and we do seem to be now in a new range for this 10-year Treasury, somewhere between 160 and 170 on the yield. So we'll just continue to watch that here. The 30-year bond, so a lot of longer-term investors talking about whether you should be further out on the curve here and you should be owning something like the 30-year, possibly even the 10-year, they largely sit in a camp that suggests that we are starting to see growth rolling over. And if you want secure yield from somewhere, maybe this is somewhere that you go to get that. What about the dollar? How's that nascent run for the dollar faring at the moment? Well, it's pretty much flat across the board here, isn't it? I could walk up and down this wall and wax lyrical about some of the different drivers, like, for example, the market's still speculating on whether the Bank of England is intending to go with an interest rate hike in November. But I think that would be a bit misleading because, quite frankly, given these slight moves, I think there's not a great deal that's giving the dollar direction here, or many of the other currencies for that matter. So what about the Asian markets? As we think about holding risk across the weekend, how are we doing in Asia? Well, I talked about that Evergrande story in the headline. We're going to talk about it a little bit more. We'll get Emily in our Hong Kong bureau to give us a report on that as well. But just starting to lift sentiment a little bit, that idea that maybe Evergrande has already earmarked the funds to make that bond payment over the weekend. What about the opening calls then? Can the European markets find another gear for this Friday session as we run into the weekend? Well, the early call, as far as these European markets are concerned, is that we will get a positive start to the trading session. And again, if the fixation is what's going on with Evergrande and the Chinese economy, then perhaps the messaging at the moment will provide some early support. Karen, very good morning to you.
Jeff, good morning to you. And what a busy week it has been on the earnings front. We've had so much news crossing from the C-suite and a lot of the commentary really focusing on cost pressures. So the commentary from the Fed important at this point as to whether those cost pressures have triggered enough inflationary concerns at the Fed to move interest rate policy at some point. And the Federal Reserve's Raphael Bostic has told CNBC he sees an interest rate hike coming later next year, as he warns inflation pressures will last well into next year.
This is going to last into 2022. Part of what the ultimate answer to how long this will take will be how quickly we resolve some of the coronavirus issues, as well as some of the supply chain challenges that are happening at a global level. I'm going to keep an open mind. You know, we talk a lot about data dependence and letting the evidence show us the way. I'm really going to lean into that as we get into the first half of 2022.
Let's get some thoughts with Paul Gamble, who is co-founder and managing director of MBMG Group. Paul, nice to catch up with you again. We have had a very busy week. And I mentioned just how thick it has been on the ground with earnings, and that's from the States, from here. The commentary has been incredible, talking about those pricing pressures, which obviously starts at the raw material side and then works its way through the whole supply chain and impacts some of these companies. We've seen some of them try to pass on those prices with higher prices for customers. What do you make of the cycle we're now seeing around inflation?
Yeah, good morning, Karen. It's obviously, like most things, it's complex because it's not linear. You know, there's this sort of bullwhip effect where we see supply shock feedback, but it's you know, we've seen waves and waves of it. It's not a straight line, and so I think that there's a huge misunderstanding, particularly by policymakers, as to what's really happening out there. There's no indication of genuine demand-driven inflation. This is all still a protracted supply shock. Yes, it's probably taken much longer to work through than most people, including ourselves, thought it would do. We expected a supply shock. We didn't realize it was going to be quite so severe. But that's because we'd never had a supply shutdown of the scale that we've seen. So, you know, we've gone from saying, yes, inflation is transitory, to now, you know, calling it TFL, transitory for longer. And therefore, if we get people like the Fed, and I thought it was interesting, you know, Bostic is saying, I'm keeping an open mind, but I think we should tighten. Well, if we get people like the Fed, who's, you know, whose only tool is a hammer, and they see everything as being a nail, if they're determined to tighten, that's actually disastrous for capital markets, because the only thing that's actually keeping capital markets at the levels they are, or the main thing that's keeping capital levels at the markets they are, is the support that we've seen from the Fed, particularly during the pandemic, but basically since the GFC.
Paul, I'm sure there's a London Transport joke in the TFL there, but I'll just push on because I want to focus on the bullwhip effect, because what we know from that is manufacturers, wholesalers are trying to get around some of the issues they're facing in the supply chain by ordering really early, which means they're not quite sure of the demand, but they're ordering just in case. And they're also placing big orders so that they have enough product in case the demand happens to be there in the next couple of months. What this means potentially is that they could have an overhang of inventory, that they really don't have a handle on the demand story, and also potentially that some of that product just doesn't come through either. So very choppy action that they're going to see in performance. Is this an environment then, as we talk about interest rate hike, that they're going to be facing enough uncertainty with inventory overhang, choppy demand forecasts, that they also have to weather some form of tightening by a central bank?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think, you know, what we have to remember is prior to the GFC, then really, you know, financing of the economy happened through primarily through commercial banks. They were the biggest player. Since the GFC, then the biggest player has been governments. And the biggest factor in that has been this growth in the Fed balance sheet from, you know, half a trillion dollars to now getting on towards $10 trillion. So it's really two parts to it. It's will governments keep putting money into the economy because we're dependent on, you know, governments for credit creation now, and will they keep putting money into capital markets? It's two different paths. And what was really interesting is that when we saw these the debt ceiling debates and crises going on in the States, both of these actually ground to a complete halt. And that's why September was so ugly. You know, you look at September, and as Leonard Cohen would say, I've seen the future and it's murder. If we don't get governments, A, supporting the economy because it still needs that, and B, supporting markets, well, both of those are going to have a problem.
Paul, Amazon is offering £1,500 if you'll go and work in Merseyside. Now, I could imagine that's because people don't want to go and work in Merseyside, but I suspect it's more to do with the fact, it's probably more to do with the fact that actually they can't get the workers. And we're seeing all of these companies now starting to offer sign-on bonuses and higher wages just to get the staff to come. Paul, as we know, inflation is not necessarily about just price hikes. It's about the psychological effect on consumers and about expectations going forward. The fact that we're now seeing these price hikes bleed into higher wage settlements and demands, doesn't that suggest that you may have to adjust your TFL statement to make it even further out on the curve if these inflation expectations become embedded?
Yeah, good morning, Jeff. It could push it further out down the curve, but actually, you know, what we're seeing is we've got probably a different reaction to that than just about anybody else in the world has, which is people are saying, well, you can't get low-paid workers to come and, you know, work at Amazon, work in, you know, fast food restaurants or whatever, so that has to be inflationary. We're actually wondering more if people haven't just readjusted their life views, you know, during the pandemic, and if people are not willing to, you know, go to Merseyside to work for Amazon to get £1,500 a month, actually that's not necessarily inflationary, but that's potentially deflationary, because it means that people are, you know, unwilling to make a whole bunch of sacrifices just to get a few quid more in their pocket, and that has a negative feedback, a negative loop into future spending. So actually, that's transitory for longer maybe, but longer term, that's structurally deflationary. And you know, the key thing here is if we look at, you know, implied break evens going forwards 10, 15, 20 years, 30 years, and using synthetics, we can go forwards 50 years. If we look at those, they're actually still telling us that there is no inflation coming for the rest of our lifetimes. And so, you know, the comments you were making earlier about people moving down the bond curve, they absolutely should. The longer term bonds are, you know, if the implied break evens are right, longer term bonds are a great place to be right now.
Yeah, and I wanted to pick up on that because what are the risks? You know, you might be fine owning the 30-year Treasury in the States. I don't know. We'll see where we go on the debt debate in the United States and what the Fed does going forward. But we just had a story at the top of the program suggesting that we will get the payment now of this offshore bond by Evergrande. Do we all breathe a sigh of relief here as the markets appear to be doing, or do we still think that there are some reasons to be worried about a disorderly default in the Chinese property sector?
I think the Chinese property sector was probably always going to be managed in a way that was going to be relatively orderly. I mean, it's a huge issue, but then, you know, I think the Chinese government are on top of this. I think there are probably other default issues and other credit issues out there that will gradually come to the fore in China and everywhere else. That'll be much less, you know, manageable. So I think we'll start, you know, to me, this is sort of the early warning sign. This is canary in the coal mine for, you know, systemic credit problems that are probably going to dog us for you know, a while to come. Evergrande didn't sort of come out of nothing. It came out of the fact that there have been problems in the Chinese property sector for over a year or so because of the Chinese government deciding to stop the exponential growth of the property sector causing even bigger problems in future. And they sort of half tackled it and half kicked it down the line. But it's more of a sort of sign of the temperature that there are, you know, really indebted companies globally that are going to be facing some problems in years to come because they're just not going to be able to achieve the growth that they need to support the debt levels they have.
Paul, you've given us a view on where you think we ought to be on the bond curve. What else do you fancy for a bit of a punt at the moment as we run up to the year end and we possibly get a seasonal equity rally?
So I think I mentioned last time that we thought Alibaba was worth watching and we thought China Tech was worth watching. They are, but they're 25% less worth watching than they were when we spoke a month ago. What I'd be more inclined to look at now is maybe Chinese domestic companies because they haven't had quite the same rally that the Alis and the China Tech have and even the US Tech. So I think, you know, the sectors that have always benefited from liquidity, technology, Chinese Tech, they're going to do well. But Chinese smaller companies are actually a really interesting place to look at right now because I think there's a bit more value there. And we you know, China's turning on the liquidity taps full blast. They'll benefit from that hugely.
Paul, we're going to say goodbye, but thanks for joining us this morning. Good to catch up and get your opinions. Paul thanks. Gambles, co-founder and managing director of MBMG Group.
Ambition to me is about doing better.
I think ambition creates a pathway.
The best advice I can give someone starting off a career is don't have a career, have lots of careers, try loads of different things.
Talk to people and put your ambition out there.
I don't feel that I've hit peak ambition because it's a learning journey.
CNBC is where ambition meets opportunity. What does living ambitiously mean to you? Hear it from our CNBC anchors, reporters and global business leaders on CNBC.com.
Renault just coming through with some numbers here. Let's have a look. Third quarter group revenue amounted to 9 billion euros. That looks to be down 13.4%, off 14% at what they call constant scope and exchange rates. The companies told us that the group order portfolio in Europe at the end of September stands at a record high for 15 years and represents 2.8 months of sales. The company says it will confirm its guidance to reach a full year group operating margin rate of the same order as in the first half of the year. But sting in the tail here, the company says the lack of components, the group anticipates loss close to 500,000 vehicles for the year. So like many of these auto manufacturers, they are grappling with supply chain challenges and shortages of semiconductors, and that has had an impact on the gross number of vehicles produced. The company, let's see if I can find you something else that's worthy of mentioning. The group says it's to achieve positive automotive operational free cash flow, excluding a change in working capital requirements for the fiscal year here. So, Charlotte, the company here reporting a decrease in sales of about 22% compared to 2020. Clearly, there are some challenges still for this French automaker with the supply chain challenge.
It's been one challenge after the other at Renault. As you remember, first the arrest of Carlos Ghosn, they had to revamp the group, the arrival of the new CEO, but of course COVID hit in the meantime. And now that we saw just some glimpses of recovery, now there's this chip shortage that is hitting production. And we had this report earlier in the week that the impact for Renault would be greater than expected. So they announced that for the third quarter, it was 170,000 units lost in Q3 due to this chip shortage. And they say for the whole year, it should be 500,000. So that's much higher than the previous number that they had given. They had given a number of something around 200,000 units of production loss for the year. Here, the number that they give this morning is something closer to 500,000 for the year. So it's much, much higher than expected, even than the report that we had earlier in the year. So, but as you said, they maintain some of their guidances of this positive free cash flow, excluding change in working capital. So they're maintaining this. So they'll be working on margins for this. So a big challenge there for Luca de Meo, the new CEO that came on board last summer. They wanted to change in depth the production model of Renault and how the alliance works with Nissan. Of course, they wanted to change from volume to margin. They've really been working hard on this, pushing for the extra investments into EV. They came up with some joint ventures in China, for example. They want to re-enter this crucial market. So a lot on the table. But of course, this chip shortage is really kind of cutting their wings a little bit. Here, but again, maintaining the CD revenue there was down 13% against the revenue that was positive in the second quarter. So it's really impacting their business there, Jeff.
I'll pick up there, Charlotte. Stay with us. We'll just bring in a couple more French stories this morning. We'll come back to you. Vivendi has posted a strong growth in the third quarter with nearly 2.5 billion euros in revenue, beating analyst expectations. The French media group's sales number in the third quarter rose 10% compared to a year before, as its paid television unit, Canal Plus, continued to post strong numbers. The company also spun off its most prized asset, Universal Music Group, last month in what was Europe's largest listing of the year, valuing the label at 45 billion euros. Meanwhile, L'Oreal's third quarter sales have beaten analysts' expectations, jumping 13% compared to last year amid strong Chinese demand. Charlotte, let me come back to this. I've just been pouring through the numbers. It feels like it wasn't just China. It was across various jurisdictions from North America to Europe to mainland China, but also across different categories. The company very much targeting salons that have reopened, of course, in recent months, but also some of the luxury end with the high-priced brands that consumers have been seeking.
And that's really interesting, Karen, because of course, luxury has been one of the engine of growth for a long time for L'Oreal. Of course, with COVID, you had an impact of people not wearing makeup as much or perfume. And now we see that luxury is really roaring back there and sales up 21%. And now it is the largest division. It used to be consumer products that was the largest division, the products that you can find in supermarkets, shampoos, etc. And now it's luxury that is, in terms of revenue, the largest segment of the business. And again, here they say that the luxury bit is led by China. China has been doing extremely well. Also, retail has been doing okay in that part. And consumer product has been more sluggish for L'Oreal, but it's coming back. And it was already the case in Q2. It's up 3.2% in Q3. And again, they mentioned this recovery in makeup, in particular, NYX and Maybelline doing particularly well. Professional product doing well. You know, people have been suffering with salons being closed. People have been coming back to the hairdresser and active cosmetics, also their smallest division, but one when they have brands like Vichy or La Roche-Posay, has been doing extremely well as well. And it keeps going very well. It's beat expectations by a mile with their sales up 28%. So overall, a very good performance there for L'Oreal. As you say, across geographies, North America has been doing very well. Sales up 23%. They mentioned that the US recovery is very much confirmed, and makeup in particular, again, has been one that has been hit the most in the past few quarters, is really coming back through. Northern Asia up 22%. They mentioned that growth in mainland China in double digit. And Europe, its largest market, of course, has been hit again by COVID, by the lack of international tourism, with sales up 7.5%. So say the overall sales is up 18%. That's way above expectation. Expectations were something close to 8%. So they did very well. And e-commerce, remember, they've been pushing through this before COVID. Of course, COVID has accelerated the transformation of their business and pushing into e-commerce. Now it makes about 27% overall of their sales. So interesting, they made a comment on price hikes, of course, with inflation. And we heard from the CEO, Nicolas Hieronymus, that joined just in May, that they will compensate cost inflation with measures including price hikes in 2022. So warning again here that price will go up for some of those L'Oreal products. And in terms of commenting on the common prosperity policy in China, that we know some luxury stocks have been hit after we saw some concern of what this would mean for spending in China from some of those luxury brands. And the CEO said he believes that this policy will benefit the middle class, which makes the bulk of their customers in the region. So they see no concerns on this point. Karen.
Let me pick up Charlotte and take us on to Evergrande, and we'll catch up with you a little bit later on. So Evergrande has reportedly made a surprise interest payment just days before a deadline on the bond would have plunged the debt-ridden property group into default. The news has sent shares in Evergrande, along with the broader Chinese real estate sector, sharply higher. Emily has the story.
China Evergrande has averted default after making a bond interest payment. Mainland media reporting that the developer wired funds to a trustee account on Thursday for a dollar bond interest payment that was due on September 23rd in the amount of $83.5 million. The 30-day grace period was due to expire tomorrow and would have put the company in formal default. We're seeing a relief rally in shares of Evergrande and its listed units today, following a more than 12% plunge in the property company yesterday as it resumed trade after the sale of its property services unit fell through. News of the payment comes after financial information provider Red reporting that the company had secured a three-month extension on a defaulted bond issue by Jumbo Fortune Enterprises. So the latest developments offer a short-term reprieve as Evergrande had altogether missed $5 bond interest payments. The next deadline is a week from today, October the 29th, the expiry of the 30-day grace period on a $45.2 million coupon payment. I'm Emily Tan in Hong Kong. Back to you.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market-moving news, you can head to CNBC.com.
Or join us again on the show with Jeff Cutmore, Steve Sedgwick and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.